From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. We continue our series on the effects of California's landmark bill, AB 5. The legislature's passed the measure, which significantly restricts businesses' ability to label those who work for them as independent contractors. We'll hear from listeners as they detail the effects on their jobs and businesses. It's right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, whether you're listening anywhere around the world on the KPCC app or through terrestrial broadcasting at 89.3 or one of our many transmitters throughout Southern California. Great to have you with us, and over the course of the next 2 hours, we've got so many topics to discuss. Later on this hour, the high cost of medical care in California. Why is it so much higher to have in-hospital procedures here than in other major American cities around the country? We'll talk about that coming up a little bit later. But first, our ongoing coverage of the landmark AB 5, a bill that dramatically changes the way workers for significant numbers of American businesses are classified. It restricts the use of the independent contractor status in many cases to provide for benefits for workers as employees, formal employees, where they would get sick leave and access to workers' compensation, to other benefits that come with being an employee, a formal employee under California law. Now, this affects ride-hailing companies. We talked yesterday about Uber, Lyft, DoorDash. The three say they're going to pledge tens of millions of dollars for a ballot measure seeking to exempt their area from coverage by AB 5. But yesterday, Uber and its chief legal officer, Tony West, put out a statement saying that essentially Uber does not see AB 5 as automatically reclassifying ride-hailing drivers from independent contractors to employees. Reading in part from Tony West's statement, AB 5 does not provide drivers with benefits, nor does it give drivers the right to organize. In fact, the bill currently says nothing about rideshare drivers. What AB 5 does is fairly straightforward, inserts into the California Labor Code a new legal test that must be used when determining whether a worker is classified as an independent contractor or an employee. And it goes on to say that they don't consider Uber under that three-part ABC test, as it's known, to have an employer relationship with drivers who work under the ride-hailing app. But I want to spend this opening segment of Air Talk today opening up the phones for you to talk about how you think this will affect your business or the job that you hold. If you're in a field where AB 5 potentially applies, what do you see as the benefits of it or causes for concern? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. We already have a Twitter comment from Independent Interpreter, who tweets at Air Talk, "I hope you're discussing an exemption for interpreters. We work with the doctors and lawyers that have the exemption. Interpreters are in business for themselves. We prefer to make our own hours, which assignments to accept, whom we choose to work with." That's Independent Interpreter, 866-893-KPECC, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Also with me from the Western States Trucking Association, Director of Governmental Affairs and Communications, Joe Rakovats. Joe, good to have you with us again. I'm interested in your members, given what Uber has taken as its legal position. Is this not applying to them? Is that something that you think your members will consider taking as their legal position?
Well, good to be here, Larry. I got to admit, I frankly like the chutzpah of Uber in what they're doing, although I don't know how they arrive at that conclusion. Our members are independent truckers, often mostly with their own operating authority from the state of California. And this absolutely upends the trucking model in the state of California.
How many members would this apply to the best of your knowledge?
Literally within our membership, we have over 6,000 motor carriers under our roof. And, you know, the average size is two trucks. So it literally is going to apply, well, it certainly will apply to every one truck operator. And it's because of the B prong. The B prong within the test says you cannot contract with a someone who's engaged in the same business enterprise. So small business truckers, owner-operators, they contract with trucking companies and intermediaries called brokers. I know that labor has said, well, you know, you're okay if you're contracting direct with the shipper. That's not going to happen. It never has happened. If you think about it from the terms of, say, a Procter & Gamble, they don't want 100,000 phone calls a day from small, you know, a single truck owner operator.
So it's going to be with these larger companies. Is there any thought that the owner operators you represent could sell their trucks to the companies so that they wouldn't have to take a loss on the purchase of the vehicle?
That's been another piece of kind of wishful thinking, is the best way to put it, that these companies are going to even have the financial wherewithal. I had that question yesterday. Well, they can just buy the trucks. Well, you know, pick your number. Say it's 50 trucks a company needs to buy. My question was, so where are they coming up with the $6 million? You know, the idea that everybody's a cash cow is absolutely wrong. As somebody who was an owner-operator, you know, I trucked for 30 years. I was an owner-operator for 25 years. I made that choice for a whole host of reasons. Not the least was because my income was significantly higher than when I was a union driver. That's a narrative that, you know, you don't hear at all because it's not convenient to the argument. Many people make very logical choices in becoming an independent contractor, whether it's because of their lifestyle and it fits their lifestyle in trucking. When I was young and had no seniority, I had to run New York City and Boston. As I got more experienced, I was like, I'm done with that, and I started to run the West. You know, it just was much, much easier, less traffic.
Do you think that your members, I'm assuming that most of them are paying loans on these trucks because they're very expensive, so I assume that there's debt on these. Is there a thought that they may walk away if the companies don't buy the trucks from them?
Well, you know, the people are going to come to different decisions, and it's really going to be interesting, you know, assuming the governor signs this, so we're hearing tomorrow, it would go into effect the first of the year. And what will start to drive decisions is how does a supply chain react to this? Do they immediately quit utilizing anybody who's an independent contractor, leaving them stranded, hanging? Well, then you have kind of a choice. You could move out of state, and I can tell you we do have people who are doing that. And you could certainly go ahead and try to sell your equipment, but I can tell you, just like anybody who goes buys a car, you're always chasing your mortgage. The minute you drive a new vehicle off the lot, it's worth a lot less than what you owe on it. Same thing's true with a commercial vehicle. So you could end up in a position of taking a bath trying to sell it. And then, of course, you have to contemplate whether you even want to become a employee driver and lose the control over your schedule, because everything once you're an employee is a forced dispatch. You don't get to tell your employer, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go there. It doesn't work that way.
You can't just tell them, these are the windows I'm willing to work. These are the routes I'm willing to drive.
That's correct. That's correct. So the final result will be, you know, and it's going to be a plaintiff's lawyer's dream come true. And that's what the law essentially, in our view, will allow, is for people to go, well, you know, you misclassified me. I can't work anymore. I'm going to sue you.
We're talking with Joe Rakovats, who's Director of Governmental Affairs and Communications for the Western States Trucking Association. He's leading off the conversation about what effect AB 5 will have in a variety of different employment sectors here in California. AB 5 significantly restricts the use of independent contractors for work that is at the core of what a company does. And so this is going to affect a lot of areas, transportation, many other fields that come under this. 866-893-KPCC. I'd like to hear from those of you who are working as independent contractors, as well as those of you who have businesses that employ independent contractors. 866-893-KPCC. KPCC. Let's talk with Constantine in Burbank. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. I've been an Uber driver for about 4.5 years, and I'm actually an organizer with the Mobile Workers Alliance, which is a coalition of Southern California Uber and Lyft drivers. And we've been pushing for AB 5 for, going on almost 2 years now. And for us, the talking points about the loss of flexibility or not being able to choose your own hours, these are like fear-mongering tactics, because the technology inherent to itself is flexibility. It's like an employee who's able to work billable hours over the weekend or negotiate with their employer their schedule and their timing. So for us, the very platform of Uber and Lyft is, it lends itself to flexibility.
But why wouldn't Uber and Lyft, if they move to an employer-employee status, why wouldn't they have people working the hours where they're greatest demand? They're not going to want to pay people for times where there's not enough business there. So they're not just going to automatically say, yeah, you work whenever you want, because they're going to have to pay an hourly wage for that under labor law. So realistically, why would Uber and Lyft just accept a driver's preferred schedule?
Because they're already doing that.
But they're not having to pay minimum wage.
But as a driver, when I log into my app, Uber and Lyft give me bonuses and extra payouts if I drive when they want me to.
Sure, but that's an inducement. That's not a guaranteed minimum wage.
Sure, I understand that. And the difference, the slight difference between those two, would have to force Uber to come to the bargaining table and negotiate with drivers on when those pays would change and when those schedules would work. So as an individual driver, as me as an individual driver, separate from organizing or bargaining, I would want my schedule to fit what I need. And so then I would go to my organizing body, whatever group of Uber and Lyft drivers are negotiating with Uber and Lyft, and I would say, hey, this is what works for me. And then as the larger body of employees, we would set our demands with Uber and Lyft and say, hey, let's talk about when people can work. Can we sign up for different schedules? If you were a driver about 3.5 years ago with Lyft, Lyft did this thing where you signed up a week ahead of time for what schedule worked for you. And that was part of their operating procedure. And then they let it go after about a year.
But Constantine, hold that thought, because I want to bring in an employment lawyer with the firm Stewart and Musil, joining us, Wendy Musil. Is that realistic in your view that if Uber and Lyft are paying minimum wage for any hours that the person is driving on the app, that they would largely accept the hours that the driver chooses?
I think that's entirely within the ability of Uber and Lyft to do so. For example, customers are going to require that at different hours of the day, meaning they're not just asking for rides at 7 p.m. or 8 a.m. Sometimes they need rides at noon. Sometimes they need rides at 2 in the morning, for example. I think a lot of this is based on their current customer base who requires rides at any time. They're certainly going to want to keep that sort of customer service that we've all begun to rely on. And an important factor that the caller has raised is that nothing stops the sort of flexibility in these industries that the drivers, they can work for multiple employers. They can have flexibility of their hours. They can work part-time. So it really is fear-mongering and a misnomer. The law explicitly indicates in it that nothing would prohibit multiple employers, flexible hours, or part-time work.
Yeah, but we'll continue because I'm not following something there. So we'll come back on this. We're talking with Wendy Musil, an employment attorney with the firm Stewart & Musil in Emeryville. Also joining us, Joe Rakovats of the Western States Trucking Association. We're talking about different industries and how AB 5 might apply to it. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back in 1 minute. Our phone line's open for you to weigh in on how you see AB 5, the measure which dramatically restricts the use of independent contracting instead of employees with access to full legally protected benefits here in California. We're at 866-893-KPCC. I'm going to get back to more calls momentarily, but I'm talking with employment attorney Wendy Musil. I just want to make sure I understand, because maybe I don't understand enough of how ride-hailing platforms work, and that may be my ignorance that I'm not getting this. But currently, as I understand it, a driver can log on, they want to work, and they can just start driving and connect themselves up to the app and pick up customers as they wish. And there are inducements, as our caller Costany talked about, there are, you know, bonuses and things that the companies can do to try and encourage people to drive during the periods where there's greater passenger demand. But if you have a guaranteed minimum wage for someone who's driving and they go to open up the app, I don't understand how Uber or Lyft could just automatically allow that to happen at any time the person wants to drive, because they may be wanting to drive at a time where there are more drivers than there's demand, and yet the company would be paying for an oversupply of drivers. So, Wendy, can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. I think there will be some adjustments in terms of how many drivers they may wish to have at any one time, but certainly that already exists. If there's not enough folks out there driving and needing rides, there's not going to be a one-to-one in any event. I think one of the major things to think about is that all of these workers are doing two and three jobs just to pay the rent, just to pay the mortgage. They're not entitled to health care. They're not entitled to minimum wage. They're not entitled to workers' compensation if they're injured on the job. Those things are not only affect those particular workers, but that affects all of us in California, where we're picking up the tab when folks have to use, for example, the emergency room, when they're unemployed. Those are things that we're all having to pay for, as opposed to the employer who is getting the benefit of all of our tax dollars. So this is simply indicating that workers deserve dignity and they deserve respect on the job. They deserve basic job protections. And there will be some adjustments, but those are adjustments that are already written into the algorithms. I'm sure that they can adjust those so that there's enough drivers for the amount of need. Additionally,
but the reason I'm still not following, because the reason I raise this is the issue of flexibility of drivers, and I don't feel like we're getting to that. But let me bring another driver into the conversation. Tim in San Diego, good to have you with us on Air Talk. So, what do you think of AB 5?
Hi, Larry. Well, I don't like AB 5. I enjoy the independence. I feel like Uber is a business for me. And I don't think there are very many businesses where I could invest so little and get such a consistent and substantial return. I'm a retired guy. I love driving Uber. I'm super grateful for Uber. And I don't see why Uber owes me anything other than if I don't like what I'm getting from Uber, I can go down the road and get another job that has benefits. What's wrong with having an organization like Uber that is for independent contractors? It's a great business. I'm proud of Uber for taking a stand on this AB5 and saying, no, we're not going to do it.
And so flexibility is something that you're really standing on. Wendy Musil, the employment attorney who's with us, her point is this is not going to intrude on flexibility. Do you think that's true?
No, I disagree. I think it will have to intrude on flexibility, and that's not what I want. If I get less flexibility, which I believe I will, I'll probably leave. I'll probably go do something else or not do anything at all, do some volunteer work or something. But yeah, I don't agree with her. I think that just simply the economics of this are going to require Uber and Lyft and other independent contractors to adjust things in a way that makes it less free for me. And I'd rather have less money and more freedom. And I don't think I have to make that choice, honestly. I can make a lot of money with Uber as much as I kind of want to, really, to within a certain limit. But
And you said $20 an hour net, so that's pretty good.
It is, yeah. And you kind of have to get to the end of the year and get your tax refund to realize that. But I think maybe some of the people that are complaining don't even know they can write their cars off or something, because that's a big part of it. With the mileage deduction.
So, all right. Tim, I appreciate it very much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Wendy Musil, what about if people wanted to work more than an eight-hour day, drive for longer, would they be able to do so with employee status?
Well, they certainly can work overtime. And just like any other workers, they should be paid for the amount of time that they work for overtime. Overtime is for any hours worked over 8 hours a day or 40 hours a week. So they would be, like every other worker, entitled to those overtime protections.
But the company could turn them down on that, right? The drivers couldn't say, I'm going to drive 14 hours today and force Uber or Lyft to pay them 14 hours, correct?
Right.
Where now they could do 12 or 14 hours, they'd be free to do that, right?
That's correct. They're free to work without minimum wage protection or overtime protection. This would allow them to have those basic job protections that all...
But that's a separate issue. I mean, that's a good point, but that's a separate issue. So they wouldn't have the same flexibility that if they wanted to work 12 or 14 hours, they didn't want Uber to stop or Lyft to stop them from doing it. They could do that. Rick in Chatsworth, you're on Air Talk.
Hello. I work in the entertainment industry. We produce scripts in localization. I'm a specialist in audio description. This whole industry that I work in is predominantly independent contractors. And number one issue is exactly what you're talking about, flexibility. And the thing is that in this business, when you're working on TV shows and films, work comes and work goes, and it ebbs and flows in huge numbers. And you might not have anything for a couple of weeks, and then you've got overflow for 3 weeks and so on and so forth. I think a key issue here is the control of the employees, the control of a person's time. Now, independent contractors, the way this business works is you have a list of contractors you go to. A job comes in. You offer it to number one, number two, number three, until you get somebody that takes the job with the terms that you have. We have very short turnarounds. You have to produce a show within 1 to 3 days. And you need to have a flexible, a lot of people that can do this sort of on call, but they have the right to turn down the business. They control their time. I have multiple people to turn to. Now, as employees, I would have to be able to control what I'm saying is they control their time right now. I would have to be able to control the time and say, guess what? You're on call today and you're in and you're on and you're going to do it. These people, they can't, they're not going to commit to a last minute like a fire drill, okay? The bell rings, they got to jump and get to work, and they got to work really hard and overtime for a couple of days to get a job done, and now all of a sudden they got nothing to do. If they have other jobs, such as your guest is suggesting, those other employees control a lot of their time too, and now I'm competing with those other employees. You see what I'm saying? It becomes a much more difficult puzzle, and that's my comment, is that it affects this industry. It's really unfair. The other thing is we have an audio description company. Naturally, we're hiring professional audio describers. And the idea that this law says that you can't hire somebody that does what you do is beyond me. And I'll finish
okay.
with the question.
Yeah, Rick, I got to move on. Quickly, the question. Yeah.
Yeah. What is the real purpose of this? How is this law important to the citizens of California? I don't understand what is the big push here. They're trying to argue it protects employees, but there's an awful lot of people that would say they don't want this. And so what's the real value for?
Well, there are two things, and those arguments have been laid out pretty clearly. The one is there is a strong belief by many people working as independent contractors that they're being taken advantage of and that they don't have access to the benefits that they should rightly be getting for what essentially is full-time, you know, permanent work in a particular field, and that employers are using the independent contractor status to take advantage and to limit their expenses at the expense of the people who are working for them. The other aspect of this is that unions do want to organize particular fields. And if you look at what's carved out and what's not carved out in AB5, the ones that had pushed for carve-outs that aren't getting them are largely areas where unions are hoping to unionize the workforce, which they can't do while people are independent contractors. So you've got a couple of major elements that back AB5 and its passage. Rick, I appreciate your call. Let's talk with Jillian in Santa Monica. You're on Air Talk.
Good morning. I want to echo a lot of what the last two callers said. I'm a management consultant, worked for a big four firm for a number of years, was a corporate development executive, top tier company, set up my own consultancy rather than going back to big four because I knew I could make more money as a business owner. And so many companies engage consultants as professional advisors, although we are not licensed like lawyers and CPAs or doctors, that we're not protected under these terms. I have a single member LLC that is taxed as an S corp, but I have run into Fortune 100 companies who wanted to engage my company services for my intellectual capital to tell them some information I knew about a specific industry, that their lawyer said, well, because it's a single member LLC, we need to treat this person as an independent contractor.
Yeah, so this has a huge effect on negative effect on your business. Jillian, I appreciate it very much. Hannah in Hollywood, good to have you with us. What effect does this have on your work?
Good morning, Larry. I'm a speech-language pathologist here in Los Angeles, and I am a sole proprietor, so I work in private practice, but I do a lot of work with some different clinics around the Los Angeles Valley as well, and have always done that as an independent contractor. So this bill is actually making it a little bit tricky to continue that kind of work because clinics are having to shift their model if somebody like me is to come in, let's say, one day a week or in an advisory type of position or in, you know, to do therapy in a very specified way, to have to envelope us in as employees becomes really challenging, especially because I've always used therapy materials as a write-off, which is a big benefit when you work for yourself. And so if I'm now an employee, still often having to provide my own materials, that no longer is a benefit to me. And it becomes really complicated for the clinic itself to figure out how do we bring these folks in to fulfill the needs that we have, who might want to do it at a higher hourly rate than what we would be paying if they were an employee.
Yeah.
And so that's really tricky. And if you're only part-time, if you're only somewhere 1 or 2 days a week, you're not working enough hours to qualify for
benefits anyway. Yeah.
So that, yeah, it's really upending that particular model.
Hannah, I appreciate it very much. I want to thank all of our callers who've joined us or posted on the Air Talk page at kpecc.org. And again, you hear the split. People who support AB5 think that this is going to bring some much-needed relief to the area in which they work. Others who see it as potentially having a negative effect on income or on the flexibility of the work they do. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Coming up, we'll talk about why California charges so much more for various medical procedures than other parts of the U.S. We'll be back right after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us today. We're joined by Dr. Marty McCary, who is surgeon and professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University and has published the new book, The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. He's also one of the researchers on a new report out of Johns Hopkins, which looks at hospital prices in the United States and the far higher prices charged in California than other parts of the country. Dr. McCary, thank you so much for joining us today on Air Talk.
Great to be with you.
Let's talk about, first of all, hospital prices generally, because, you know, when you look at the profits that insurance companies make, what physicians make, what, you know, the different aspects, different strata of the healthcare system, you point out it's the hospitals that are generally, not across the board, but generally making out like gangbusters. Why is that?
Well, hospitals are on track to have their highest profit margin in history. It's going to hit 5.1% this year. At the same time, some small and rural hospitals are closing, but the mass consolidation probably has created enough market dominance to allow price gouging. And if there's one thing that's defined healthcare in the last 5 years, it's the increased business model of gouging out of network, predatory billing, and overpriced and surprise bills. In my opinion, as a physician, this kind of money game, gouging stuff, violates the public trust in the medical profession, and we need to call it out. These bills were inflated a lot of times for insurance companies to get discounts. It's illogical. It makes no sense. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's a lot of this because the system is so unbalanced. You've got reimbursements for publicly reimbursed health care that is, in many cases, less than the cost of the service. So private insurance then overpays to make up the difference?
Well, that's what we're told. But there's a lot of research that I present in the book that shows that's really not what's happening. What's happening is that when hospitals get market dominance, they get monopoly power. It allows, not always, and it's variable, but some systems, when they get that power, use it to increase prices, and they can have a stronger leverage point at the negotiating table with insurers. The problem is people get caught up in between because those high prices were never intended for individuals to pay, yet they're being asked to pay that. They're coming in out of network, right? You go to an in-network hospital, and then you get an out-of-network bill? That's crazy, right? That's a bait and switch. We need more honesty with these prices, and that's why these disruptors who are offering real prices, not just sticker prices that are phony, are starting to change the market and the landscape.
Speaking of the monopoly, you point to Northern California as being one of the worst offenders because the hospital groups are so large, it's limited competition.
Yeah, we're told it's charity care, right? We're told we have all these people that don't pay, and that's why we charge so much. That's rarely the case, okay? The research that I present show that, in fact, it's what the market will allow. So take, for example, Vail Ski Resort. There's a hospital there that charges astronomical rates. Do they take care of so many uninsured, homeless people and immigrants at Vail Ski Resort that they have to make it up on the bills? No, they're charging as much as the market will allow. They've got people with sucker plans that'll just pay whatever is charged. And so this game of gouging has defined the modern business practices of billing.
We're talking with Dr. Marty McCary of Johns Hopkins. He's author of The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. You have a question on the economics of American medicine. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What are the ways that health consumers can try and avoid the trap of, you know, getting physicians who are out of network, who are providing a particular service when someone's hospitalized or getting a procedure? So I think so often people feel like, first of all, when they're undergoing this, they've got a lot of other things to worry about beyond getting a disclosure of prices in advance. But secondly, you have no idea of, you know, who the doc affiliated with what network is going to show up on the day you got your procedure.
You know, when people demanded nutrition labels on food, we got it. The industry told us they just can't do that, right? They argued it would be catastrophic for the food industry. But you know what? We demanded it and we got it. If enough people ask for prices, then the labor and delivery units at different hospitals are going to give pregnant moms a price. If enough people ask before they have an MRI, they're going to get a price. Use the website, one of the many tools I offer in the book, the website mdsave.com, an online platform where you can shop for shoppable services in healthcare. And don't sign your life away when you walk into the emergency room. There's a law in the United States that says hospitals have to take care of you for anything emergent. You don't have to sign your life away financially or give your credit card. And finally, negotiate your bills. They're very negotiable. And if you've been truly gouged, we offer 20 different things people can do to fight it. They're in the book, and they're also at restoringmedicine.org.
How do you determine, though, whether you've objectively been gouged or not? You get a bill, and you're asked, you know, to pay a certain amount out of pocket. Where do you go to determine whether that is, it may be painful, but may be reasonable? How do you determine whether it's reasonable or not?
So there's a blue book value of a lot of the services, and you can actually type in the codes that appear in your itemized bill into these websites. Healthcare Blue Book, Fair Health is another one, and you can look up what the going rate is. But people need to know that a lot of things that show up in their bills were not even rendered. There's some good research that shows people are charged for things they've never received, or they're charged things in duplicate when they only received it once. Those are the easiest things to get knocked off your bill. And finally, ask for compassion. I mean, hospitals that sue patients and garnish their wages, including one hospital that sued 25,000 people in a town of 28,000 that I visit in the book. I went to the hospital and said, "You're violating the public trust. People are supposed to come to the hospital when they're weak and vulnerable, and we docs and nurses take care of them. What you're doing is unethical." I reminded them why we went into medicine, and they stopped doing it. We're going around the country doing that now. We need more public accountability. You can take your bills to the hospital board members or executives themselves and engage your doctor. A lot of times we doctors are out of the loop, and when we find out what's going on, we're outraged.
What is the place for state or federal regulation here? What sorts of demands, if any, do you think should be put on hospitals for price disclosure that aren't mandated now?
Well, we should not be allowing in the United States secret medical prices negotiated by insurance companies and hospitals in private to not be public information. Look, community hospitals were built to serve their communities. Many were built by churches. They were funded by charity. They served anyone, regardless, according to their charter, of one's race or creed or ability to pay. That is our great medical heritage. And so people need to hold our institutions accountable. And there's a lot you can do by going directly to the hospital. I think governments will probably do nothing on this issue. The special interests are so strong. But if we make better choices, navigate the system, create pressure, we're seeing it with employers who know they're getting ripped off on their insurance and pharmacy benefit plans, and the self-funded employers that get ripped off on their hospital bills they've got afoot. We can make better decisions and move this market, whether or not the government does anything.
We're talking with the author of The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It, Dr. Marty Makary, joining us. Dr. Makary is with Johns Hopkins University, where he's professor of health policy. He's also a surgeon as well, and one of the researchers on the new Johns Hopkins report on hospital prices in the U.S., which analyzes U.S. cities and states. Northern California comes across just about as bad as can be for higher costs. California is a state as a whole significantly higher than the average for the rest of the U.S. We're at 866-893-KPECC. If you want to talk healthcare costs, we'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Just ahead in the second hour, we'll talk about the U.S. Supreme Court decision yesterday that, at least for now, allows the Trump administration to move forward with its limitation on asylum claims. Those seeking asylum required to make the request of another country that they come through first before arriving at the U.S. We'll talk about the implications for those traveling to the U.S. seeking asylum, as well as those already in the pipeline of the process. That's next hour here on 89.3. Right now, we're talking with Dr. Marty McCarry of Johns Hopkins University. He's professor of health policy at JHU, and he's a surgeon there as well. We're taking your calls with your questions about the costs of health care. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Another thing that you target in the book, Dr. McCarry, is the whole idea of sort of health screenings and the like. You say this is often used, it's less altruistic about helping people discover if they might have dangerously high blood pressure or screening for diabetes and the like, that often this is designed to find things for which people can be tested that's a very low risk or no risk whatsoever. Elaborate, please.
That's right. You know, we should not confuse good prevention with lifestyle changes and health and food as medicine and all the good stuff that we're learning about right now. That should not be confused with screenings. Health screenings are sometimes predatory. They're sometimes used, we found in doing the research for the book, a recruiting tool, even at churches. Look, the screening guidelines are very clear. They're from the United States Preventive Services Task Force. But yet we found a lot of groups pushing the envelope, doing things that are not indicated. So people should know that when somebody comes and says, hey, we're going to screen you for everything under the sun. We should probably be thinking more about getting at the root problems of disease. We should talk about treating abdominal pain with food as medicine and maybe managing diabetes with cooking classes as much as we do with insulin. You know, maybe back pain should be treated more with physical therapy and ice than it is surgery and opioids for that stuff. So doctors are starting to recognize this new movement to precision medicine. It's got several names, but this sort of holistic approach. We're learning more about the microbiome. Look, I'm a gastrointestinal surgeon. I put some of the newest research and some of the stuff everyone should do in the book. But we want to spend time with patients. We doctors are sick of the throughput billing model. Patients hate it too. And this new generation of clinics surging around the United States are called relationship-based clinics. Check them out. If you're over 65, you can usually sign on for free. Medicare will cover it. It's Landmark, Iora, ChenMed, a lot of great stuff. Oak Street, a lot of great stuff happening right now in healthcare.
Relationship-based, you said?
Relationship-based clinics. We also see it for people under 65 in the form of direct primary care, concierge, although it can be expensive, concierge care, and doctors spending time to go through your refrigerator with you and see what you're eating and talk about the myths that we doctors probably could be more humble about and apologize for, like demonizing saturated fats. Okay, that was wrong. And where's the apology from the American Heart Association? We moved everybody into a high carbohydrate, high processed added sugar diet in order to avoid fat. And yet you still see people talking about it, even in the hospital, in the heart center, in the ICU, when you leave, you're given a pamphlet at my hospital on the benefits of the low-fat diet. You know, come on, we need to mature, and we need to recognize the microbiome is behind a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, when you mentioned concierge medicine, you know, I always think of that in terms of doctors who, there's enough demand for their services that they can use it as a sort of a surcharge because they're not happy with the reimbursements that they get. But you're describing something that really is much more involved with the patient, more labor intensive, and that is available?
Yeah, that's growing like crazy around the United States. There's a market for it. Like any market with transparent prices, you're going to see a global reduction in the price. There's great health educators out there for free. I mean, look at Peter Attia and his podcast, The Drive. Look at a lot of the new teaching that's recognizing that we shouldn't be telling everyone to drink 4 glasses of cow's milk a day and avoid fat and all this nonsense. No, we should be promoting a healthy microbiome and testing people instead of that panel that everyone gets tested for. Test them for LDL cholesterol and how about lipoprotein A? LP little a is a test everyone should have done at least once in their lifetime. It predicts early heart disease, but few doctors have ever heard of it. It's one of the many tips that I give patients in this sort of concept of relationship-based medicine and the new redesign of healthcare that gets rid of billing and focuses on prevention.
Dr. McCary, I also wanted to ask about different structures for payment of health services. We've had a number of listeners ask about, would a single payer either option or everybody going to single payer, would that at all relate to this issue? Would that avoid the problems with transparency if the government is the reimburser across the board? What do you think?
Well, I think step one is we need to cut the waste. And I understand the appeal of Medicare for All and the single payer system by many people because it does get rid of some of these money games and the middlemen. But recognize that over time, invariably, governments underfund healthcare by making small across-the-board cuts every year over time. Governments simply cannot resist. It's 100% guaranteed. It's universal. It's already happened in our Medicare system, by the way. We now spend, a new study from Hopkins that's coming out today, of all federal spending by the United States government, 48% goes to healthcare in all its hidden forms. So what are we suggesting, really? Increasing that higher? We can talk about different ways to finance the broken healthcare system. Let's have that discussion. But first, we need to have an honest conversation about how to fix it. Politicians talk about different ways to finance healthcare. We need to fix it. Step one is to cut the waste, restore medicine to its mission, and let's start with honest and fair, transparent pricing. If airlines billed you after the flight, guess what? You'd get gouged every time. And they might tell you, oh, we can't give you a price before the flight because we don't know if it'll be delayed or canceled or if you'll consume a beverage. Well, guess what? We have transparent pricing. Healthcare can do the same for shoppable services, and we can create competition to end price gouging in American medicine.
Just real quickly, Dr. McCary, are there any hospital chains that provide the anticipated pricing up front? Do you know of any?
Sure. There's urgent care clinics now in Los Angeles that are providing a set number of set prices for certain things like certain types of suturing and other basic services. The Surgery Center of Oklahoma has created the Free Market Medical Association. They all post prices like a menu, and it doesn't matter who's paying, insurance or an individual. It's one honest, fair price.
Dr. Marty McCary joining us from Johns Hopkins University, where he's professor of health policy and a surgeon as well. Dr. McCary, thank you for being with us.
Great to be with you.
His book is The Price We Pay, What Broke American Healthcare and How to Fix It. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, back with the second hour momentarily. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific day. So glad to have you with us. Have you heard of hard seltzer? I hadn't heard of it until very recently. But apparently it is the latest hot beverage. Hard seltzer is carbonated water combined with some sort of an alcoholic product. It might be fermented cane sugar. It might be a malt beverage, and it's flavored. These products have become hugely popular. In fact, one of them, White Claw, is sold out just about everywhere it's on sale. We're going to talk about the impact of it, why it's so popular, and whether this is a sector of the beverage industry likely to last or just the latest fad. But first, we begin with yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision, which temporarily undoes a lower court ruling that had blocked the administration's new asylum policies in some states along the southern border. The policy denies asylum to anyone who passes through another country on the way to the U.S. without seeking asylum protection there. This obviously has a huge effect on Mexico, because people coming to the southern U.S. border, whether they're from Central America, whether they're from an African nation, somewhere in Asia, from Europe, if they're coming to the southern U.S. border, they're coming through Mexico. So this would require them to seek asylum there if they're seeking that sort of status in the U.S. Question is, how is Mexico going to respond to this? Also, what does this mean for people in the pipeline? And what are the likely reasons why the U.S. Supreme Court took this action? We begin with Jorge Valencia, who's a correspondent with NPR member station KJZZ Phoenix. Jorge, good to have you with us. Do we have any sense of how the Mexican government is going to respond to thousands of people now having to make the application in Mexico?
Good morning. Thank you so much. So for now, the Mexican government is taking a measured approach. Foreign Relations Secretary Marcelo Ebrard, he said in a press conference this morning, he called the U.S.'s measure astonishing. But Mexico for a long time has been taking a very measured approach to U.S. policy that somehow impacts it, because it doesn't want to sort of provoke President Trump, to be honest. And so at this point, they're just saying, we have a very different immigration policy than the United States does. We will not follow suit. We will not implement these types of policies. And that's it for now. I mean, like you said, this will very likely have a very, very big impact on Mexico, because there are thousands of people from all over the world on border cities on the Mexican side right now waiting for their turn to apply for asylum. And it is very likely that if not all of them, most of them are going to get stuck there. But at this point, the Mexican government is just saying this is astonishing. It's the U.S.'s decision, and we will not follow suit with similar policies.
I don't know if you remember, a while back there was an effort of the Trump administration to do this, and Mexico agreed, and I wish I remember the details, but that they were going to entertain asylum requests, and there was tremendous pushback from the public in Mexico over taking in large numbers of asylum seekers. And I was wondering, is the Mexican government concerned that if they do significantly increase the numbers of people that they allow to permanently stay under asylum law, that that's going to provoke a backlash?
Okay, so the answer to that is that it's true. It is likely that if you're from Bangladesh, if you're from Nigeria, and it took you 2 hours to get here, to get to Mexico, to the border with the U.S., which I have met numerous people who tell these types of stories, it is very likely people will get stuck in Mexico. So it is true that Mexico is facing the possibility that there will be thousands of people all the way from Tijuana to Matamoros, which is on the other side of Texas. That is true. But just to disentangle a little bit, very briefly, the recent history of sort of asylum between the two countries is that there is a policy right now that the United States has implemented unilaterally that the Trump administration refers to as Remain in Mexico. So what they did was that they said, we're going to take asylum applications for people from wherever, and then we are going to send them back on the border, and then we're going to send them back to Mexico and make them wait there for their hearings. So on that side, there's already thousands of people who have applied for asylum in the United States, and they're waiting for their hearings in Mexico. So there's that. And then there's this other policy that the United States has been pursuing for a while. The Trump administration has been pursuing it with Mexico and with other countries in Central America as well, which they refer to this as a safe, third country agreement. And so basically what that does is that says that the person has to apply for asylum elsewhere and be denied there before they can apply for asylum in the United States. Mexico has refused to do this, like, aggressively. They categorically said, we will not be a safe third country. And so what this does, this Supreme Court decision, at least for now, is that it allows the Trump administration to do a version of that without having to get in the buy-in from Mexico or from Guatemala or from Honduras or from El Salvador. So at this point, it is very likely that there will be many thousands of people from all over the world who wanted to petition for asylum in the United States who are going to be in border cities in Mexico. Many of them are very dangerous border cities. Many of them are places where they are preyed upon by these asylum seekers, are preyed upon by organized crime. So again, just going back to the main point, at least for now, that Mexico is taking a measured approach, and they're not really weighing in very heavily because they have more to lose with the Trump administration because they have their own negotiations related to trade and to migration. And so Mexico at this point is just trying to take a measured approach.
I guess I was wondering, are they gearing up for having thousands of people potentially, you know, applying for asylum in Mexico? Is Mexico assuming that's not going to happen?
I don't know. I think it would be foolish to think that it isn't going to happen. The thing is that Mexico has been gearing up to receive those asylum applications at least for a year. We started seeing sort of this big increase that was very visible last autumn when we saw these large groups of people, hundreds or thousands of people who would travel together from Central America to get to the United States. Colloquially, people refer to them as migrant caravans. Mexico has seen that and has received like a large influx of people applying for asylum because a few say, okay, fine, you know, maybe I do want to stay in Mexico. The thing is that the Mexico's immigration arm is severely just strapped and underfunded. So regardless of whether or not they are gearing up to receive this large influx of asylum applications, they already are struggling to meet with the demand that they have already. So I don't have a crystal ball. And
I
guess what's going to happen, but it's very likely not going to look very pretty.
Yeah, it sounds like they're going to be overwhelmed. We're talking with Jorge Valencia, correspondent with NPR member station KJZZ in Phoenix. He's with their Mexico City Bureau. Also joining us, Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News, Greg Storr. Greg, good to have you with us again. Your sense of what the court is saying in this rebuke to the lower court and enabling this to go forward.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me on. The court didn't give us a whole lot. In fact, they didn't give us any reasons at all for staying the lower court orders and therefore letting the Trump policy take effect. That happens a lot of times with the court on these emergency applications. So we're left to sort of parse through what we think they might have been thinking. There has been an awful lot of concern throughout the judiciary, certainly by the Trump administration, about federal trial judges who issue these nationwide injunctions that stop an administration policy just by the vote of that single judge. And that may have been part of what was going on here. One of the mysteries of this order is that we know that two of the nine justices, Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, dissented, and they explained their reasons. But we don't know why two of the other generally liberal justices, Elena Kagan and Stephen Breyer, or Chief Justice John Roberts, who's often in the center of the court these days, we don't know what they were thinking, why they weren't also in dissent, what concerns they might have about the Trump administration policy that they chose not to air at this point. All we know is that the court let this policy go into effect while the legal fight plays out.
I don't recall in the past, and I may just be ignorant of this, but where you had a single federal judge who would issue a sweeping order, a stay like this, when you're talking about a presidential administration policy. And obviously the Trump administration is unique in a number of ways. But you raised that there are concerns of this. The Trump administration has expressed it. I've seen where conservatives have generally expressed concern about this happening. if you've had cases like this in the past, has it generally been more like three judge panels or a en banc district federal court that's weighed in on it, as opposed to a single judge?
No, there have been a lot of single judge instances, and all these, I should say, do go through the Federal Appeals Court first. So the Supreme Court acted after the litigation bounced up and down, but it did go to the Ninth Circuit, the Federal Appeals Court that's based in San Francisco, and they essentially let the lower court order stay in effect, let the Trump administration's policy be blocked, at least in a couple of states. But we've had this sort of issue where we're having it now with the deferred deportation fight over the Obama administration's DACA program, and the Trump administration's bid to rescind that program. We had it when a more conservative judge blocked President Obama from trying to expand that DACA program and apply it to, among other people, the parents of children who came over here when they were underage. It's been a brewing fight, and as we're in this more polarized environment, both politically and judicially, we are seeing more and more litigants opposed to an administration policy going to a judge, getting what they want, and it's left to the Supreme Court to decide what to do about it.
Greg, could lower courts still, because you know they still have the ball now, could they block this from moving forward despite what the Supreme Court said? In other words, they hear the actual arguments on this and render a decision?
As a practical matter, probably not. This order is going to stay until it applies, basically until the case is resolved. So you may get orders from lower courts that say, on the merits, we have decided the Trump administration does not have the authority to do that. But as a practical matter, the policy is going to stay in effect until this litigation is totally finished, and that probably will be after the Supreme Court has weighed in on the merits of it.
You think they're likely to take this up in the upcoming term?
Well, there's certainly a question about the timing of it. As a general matter, cases might take a couple years to get up to the Supreme Court. This is still at a very early stage. This policy was only put in place back in July. It remains to be seen how quickly the lower courts can move this along, and therefore whether we could actually get a Supreme Court decision on the merits of it before the term ends in June.
All right. And of course, this very dependent on the presidential election. If President Trump isn't reelected, presumably the policy would be withdrawn anyway. It might make the legal matter moot.
That's certainly possible. I wouldn't want to prejudge too much because, as I mentioned with the DACA policy, the deferred deportation policy, sometimes you can have issues when the president tries to rescind a policy of a predecessor. But yet, certainly I would imagine that if a Democrat wins the White House in the next presidential election, they will try very quickly to rescind this policy and do it in a way that would insulate that move from any legal challenge.
Greg, good to talk with you again, as always. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg News, Greg Storr. Also, our thanks to KJZZ NPR member station Mexico City correspondent Jorge Valencia for sharing with us what the impact is for those seeking asylum in the U.S., given yesterday's U.S. Supreme Court decision allowing the Trump administration's new policy on asylum seekers to move forward. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. On a much lighter note, with much less human impact, but certainly of interest, the growing fan base for hard seltzer. What is it? How are the different ways it's made? And why is it so popular, particularly among younger drinkers? We'll find out in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're going to get to our segment on hard seltzer momentarily, but we have breaking news. The initial report on the disastrous fire of the Conception early Labor Day morning, that ship that caught fire just 20 yards off the shore of Santa Cruz Island in the Channel Islands. We have the first report that is scheduled to come out within about 10 days of the accident. The National Transportation Safety Board has released it. I've just gotten the two-page report, and I'm going to read from this. Now, this is not the final report. That could be a year or more away. But let me really read some select paragraphs of this report. Initial interviews of three crew members revealed no mechanical or electrical issues were reported. At the time of the fire, five crew members were asleep in berths behind the wheelhouse, and one, and that's the top deck, by the way, and one crew member was asleep in the bunk room, which was accessed from the salon down a ladder well in the forward starboard corner of the compartment. The bunk room had an emergency escape hatch located on the aft end, which also exited to the salon. There were two locally sounding smoke detectors in the overhead of the bunk room. A crew member sleeping in the wheelhouse berths was awakened by a noise and got up to investigate. He saw a fire at the aft end of the sun deck, rising up from the salon compartment below. The crew member alerted the crew behind the wheelhouse. As crew members awoke, the captain radioed a distressed message to the Coast Guard. The crew members attempted to access the salon and passengers below. Unable to use the aft ladder, which was on fire, the crew members jumped down to the main deck. One crew member broke his leg in the process and tried to access the salon and galley compartment, which was fully engulfed by fire at the aft end and by thick smoke in the forward end through a forward window. Unable to open the window and overwhelmed by smoke, the crew member jumped overboard, the crew jumped overboard, excuse me. Two crew members and the captain swam to the stern, reboarded the vessel, opened the hatch to the engine room, and saw no fire. Access to the salon through the aft doors was blocked by fire, so they launched a small skiff and picked up the remaining two crew members in the water. They transferred to a recreational vehicle, a vessel anchored nearby, the Grape Escape, where the captain continued to radio for help, while two crew members returned to the Conception to search for survivors around the burning hull. Local Coast Guard and fire departments arrived on scene to extinguish the fire and conduct search and rescue. The vessel burned to the waterline by morning and subsequently sank in about 60 feet of water. It goes on to say later in the report, investigators have collected documents from recent Coast Guard inspections and visited another Truth Aquatics vessel, Vision, a vessel similar to the Conception. Salvage operations to bring the wreckage to the surface for examination and documentation have begun. Investigators plan to examine current regulations regarding vessels of this type, year of build and operation, early warning and smoke detection and alarm systems, evacuation routes, training, and current company policies and procedures. Efforts continue to determine the source of the fire. So this is the preliminary report, as you heard, largely based on interviews with the crew members, as opposed to forensics of the wreckage of the Conception, which they're looking at raising what remains of the Conception, raising that from the floor about 60 feet of water, and then doing forensics to better understand what happened with it. We have a copy of the report. AirTalk has tweeted it out on our Twitter account if you want to see it. It sounds as though from this report, if I'm reading this accurately, that there was not a crew member who was awake overnight, as my understanding is, according to the Coast Guard, as is required in a vessel like this that has those 34 individuals sleeping in the bunks down below. because this says five crew members were asleep in berths behind the wheelhouse. That would seem to indicate they were not complying with the demand for having a crew member who was awake and alert and able to be on lookout overnight as people sleep. We'll undoubtedly have additional details later this afternoon right here on 89.3 KPCC. We turn our attention now to the growing popularity of hard seltzer. I hadn't even heard of this market category, but apparently White Claw is incredibly popular, is even sold out in many locations, and you have other major beverage manufacturers like AB, Anheuser-Busch, who have come up with their own versions like Natural Light. Joining us to talk about what's happened with this beverage that's blown up recently, Craig Giamona, who covers the cannabis beverage, food, and restaurant industries for Bloomberg. Craig, good to have you with us. So what is hard seltzer?
Well, it's basically seltzer with alcohol in it. It's one way to think about it is kind of like LaCroix or some of those popular brands, but essentially with alcohol. And it's, as you mentioned, it's an incredibly popular and fast-growing segment of the alcohol industry at this point.
Who are the people drinking it?
Mainly young people. I mean, I think it skews younger. There was a notion when it first started that I think it skewed female a little bit, but there's certainly plenty of young men drinking it. But I do think sort of people over 40 or wherever you want to draw the line, maybe 35, really haven't heard of it or it's not on the radar, but it's incredibly popular kind of with younger drinkers, so sort of young millennials and even some of those older Gen Z drinkers.
Is this much the same audience that would drink Mike's Hard Lemonade or other flavored malt beverage products, or is this seen as breaking through to a demographic that wouldn't have consumed those types of beverages?
You know, in my opinion, I think it's breaking through a little bit. It's interesting that the company that makes Mike's Hard Lemonade are the people that make White Claw. But really what's happened here is that these beverages are, you know, lower calorie and often gluten-free. So, you know, Mike's Hard Lemonade is incredibly sweet. So, I mean, that's something that maybe you drink in high school or in your college days. With White Claw, what they've done here is, you know, because it has that 100 calorie, you know, and people are just so calorie conscious these days and less sugar, there is a much wider audience, in my opinion, for the products.
All right. Also with us, Eric Schmidt, Director of Alcohol Research at the Beverage Marketing Corporation. Thank you, Eric, for being with us. What are your thoughts about how this beverage has been able to break through, particularly with younger drinkers?
Well, I think that younger drinkers, you know, the younger segment of the population is very health conscious. I think that, you know, there's a wide trend towards sober curious. So a lot of these people don't drink at all. And if they do drink, there's the, you know, the perception that, you know, drinking a seltzer is healthier. They're lower in calories. It's more natural. So I think that that's kind of a lot of the trends that are you know, kind of bucking this whole, you know, hard seltzer, you know, trend going on.
How does the marketing of the products reflect that?
Well, I think a lot of it is, you know, it's going through social media. It's going, you know, a lot of viral stuff. White Claw just came out with stuff that you know, kind of went viral. And it's a lot of word of mouth. I mean, the younger population, it's not so much, you know, where you're going to see, you know, mainstream ads. It's more word of mouth. It's, you know, it's kind of growing that way. And I think marketers are really kind of pushing the advertising that way or you know, their expenditures that way.
I was reading an article that it's gender neutral advertising showing women, young women and men together. It's not sexualized as often you see in beer commercials that are aimed at men. And I wonder if that's because that was their sense of who was already attracted to the beverage, or if this was consciously from the beginning an approach that they were going to take. What do you think, Eric?
I think it's more the latter. I think that, you know, beer has been suffering in a lot of categories. So this is a segment, although, you know, it's a little bit different segment of the category that's been doing well. And they're trying to get as many consumers into it. And if it's only if it's only one gender specific, it's, you know, you're taking away half of, you know, the population. So I think that they're really trying to be cognizant and pushing it, that it's something that can be consumed by everyone, because it's like I said, it's a segment of the market that's really had a lot of growth, and I think that they're really trying to push that.
Let's talk also about the different ways that the product is made. So if it's gluten-free, I'm presuming you can't make it in the same way that you would a typical flavored malt beverage, where you're taking grain products to make the alcohol. Eric Schmidt, can you speak to the process that enables it to be gluten-free?
No, I can't really speak to, you know, I deal with more statistics and the background behind it, but not so much how it's made.
Craig, can you speak to that?
You know, not really either, but I do know that that's a big, it is a flavored malt beverage. And I mean, the difference, the innovation really from the days of Mike's Hard Lemonade to White Claw is that they've managed to kind of mask the flavor of it, but do that without adding calories, without adding sweeteners. You know, my understanding is that they don't use vodka for these because liquor is taxed higher than flavored malt beverages are. So they're using that malt base, but that whereas Mike's Hard Lemonade needed a bunch of sweet stuff to kind of cover up the flavor, they've gotten to a point now where they have that clean, crisp sort of seltzer flavor, but still low calorie and gluten free.
So my understanding was that a number of them, like White Claw, suspected that they use cane sugar and ferment that because then it can be gluten free. Or in the case of some of the others, there's a process where they can use the grain-based alcohol and ferment that as you would with a malt liquor, but then be able to remove the gluten from that to make it gluten-free, which I thought was pretty interesting that they've developed the technology to be able to do that. If you have questions for our guests about these hard seltzers, how they're made, why they're so popular, and your thoughts on whether this is a beverage fad, we've certainly seen plenty of those, or whether this is likely to have legs, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Eric, are there different levels of alcohol in these different hard seltzers, or are all of them low alcohol beverages?
No, it's interesting you say that because they were typically lower alcohol, so they would be around, you know, 4 or 5%. But now we're starting to see products like PBR put out a hard seltzer that was 8%, and then Four Loko, who you know came out with that the high alcohol content flavored malt beverage, their thoughts are they're going to put a product out later this year that's supposed to be 14%. So while most of them are on the lower end of the ABV spectrum, there are products now coming to market that are higher.
So what are they essentially equivalent of what a light beer would be? Most of these?
Lower scale, yes.
Yeah, okay. So people could feel like, okay, I could drink a can of White Claw or Natural Light or whatever, and I'm not taking in more alcohol than I would from a can of light beer.
Correct.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. I want to thank Craig Giamona, who's with us from the Cannabis Beverage Food and Restaurant Industries. Eric Schmidt, also with us, Director of Alcohol Research at the Beverage Marketing Corporation. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Also want to alert you that coming up at noon on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, her guest will be Kate O'Neill, author of Waste, a book which gets into the big challenges in recycling now. Now that China isn't taking all that recycled waste, what actually is getting recycled and how are cities dealing with that? Back after a live update from Hetty. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. Hope you're having a good start to your day. Reminder, tomorrow, Film Week at 11 o'clock right here on 89.3. We got some big movies out tomorrow. Our critics will tell you all about them. Also, we hear from Peter Rayner at the Toronto International Film Festival. North America's biggest, and all kinds of films that are undoubtedly going to be in Oscar contention. Peter will join us from Toronto to talk about the best movies that he has seen over the previous few days. But first, today, joining us is acclaimed writer Walter Mosley, creator of the E.Z. Rollins series of books, who's written so many other genres of books as well, and also a writer and producer of television programming. Last Friday, he wrote an essay in the New York Times titled "Why I Quit the Writer's Room," in which he detailed how he got a call from Human Resources after he had, in a writer's room meeting for the streaming Star Trek series for which he'd been writing, he had been recounting an anecdote in which a police officer used a racial epithet, and Walter said the actual word that the police officer said. Someone was apparently offended in the writer's room, contacted Human Resources, who then contacted Walter Mosley. He joins us to talk about this experience. He details in the piece. Walter, good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
It's great to be here. Thanks a lot, Larry.
I appreciate it. So describe for us what happened when you got that call. What did the HR representative say to you?
Well, it was an interesting talk. It was kind of funny. The guy said, my name is so-and-so. I want to say that it's been reported that you use the N-word in the writer's room. And I said, well, I am the N-word in the writer's room. And he said, well, you can't say that. You can't use that language. I mean, he says, no, if you want to write it in a script, that's fine, but you can't, utter the word.
And so how did you respond to that?
Well, the conversation went on a little while. I mean, he wasn't a bad guy. I think he felt a little nervous saying it to me. And I just said, okay. And I hung up and I went home and I never went back to work. Honestly, you can't be in a creative environment, a space where your language is being monitored. You can be creative, but don't say this. You can be creative, but don't think that. It went way beyond that in my head. I'm like, well, if I can't say something, if I'm an American, I live in America, it's freedom of speech. If I'm not, bullying you, I'm not harassing you, I'm not humiliating or insulting you in any way, I'm just using language, and the language I use makes you unhappy, well, let's have a conversation and maybe or maybe not I'll stop doing that. But if instead I don't even know who called me, and then somebody else calls me and says, if you speak like this, then we're going to have to fire you, I can't be there.
One of the things I'm a little surprised by, this is in a writer's room. I'm assuming everybody there is a writer like you are. I would anticipate anybody who's writing for a television series at this level would feel comfortable coming to you and say, Walter, I know you're recounting a story here, but when I hear that word, I have a visceral reaction. It's hurtful and offended. Would you mind not using it in the future? Why do you think someone didn't come to you and say that?
I have no idea. I have no idea why they didn't come to me. I do know that, if somebody had said to me what you just said, I might or might not stop. I don't even know what I think about that. I said, well, because if I'm talking. But nobody did. And I it's never happened before. So I don't know. They didn't. It might have to do with dynamics about the room itself. I'm not sure.
This is a mixed race and ethnicity writers' room, right? You've got it's pretty broad representation.
Yeah. It's there. I don't know. Could have been a black person who said it. I don't know. All I know, because my problem wasn't with them. It was with the writer, with HR, because HR could have called. Listen. And this whole notion, this kind of McCarthyistic notion that somebody, name names, and now we're going to call you, and now we're going to call you in front of the Congress, and now maybe you're going to go to prison. I don't know. It's like it doesn't matter. What matters, what bothered me is how that bosses, all of whom represent a white business, call me and tell me that. We don't believe that you should use that word. And I'm saying, nobody ever called you this word. You never lived in a world where this word was part of your life. Why are you telling me? Why are you saying this to me?
What I have to, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on to talk about this, I completely understand your position, where you're coming from. I also understand, though, the HR position, because if someone, let's hypothetically say it was a fellow African-American writer on the staff who, for whatever reason, she or he didn't feel comfortable coming to talk with you. And it'd be hard to surmise on why that might be. But so they go to HR and make the complaint. How would HR respond to that if not coming to you and sharing that concern?
Listen, it's wrong for HR to exist in this form. Like, we should talk. Me and the person, if there's a problem with me and somebody else in the room, we should talk. Hear it. I mean, that's just the way it is.
So you think HR should have said to the person who made the complaint, look, you need to talk with him about it directly. This is not our job.
Well, or they could say, we'll set up a meeting. Yeah, I don't mind if they do. They could have a job where they like do stuff, but the idea that, like, for instance, so if I say something about you, and I say, well, he said this and he said that, okay. I mean, that might be true. It might not be true, right? It might be the right situation. It might not be the right situation. Somebody might actually say something I said, but not in the way I said it because of the way they interpreted it, right? Instead of anybody worrying about that, they called me and they said, because they just say, the person said they don't want to get you in trouble. And I asked, but aren't I in trouble if you're calling me? And they went, well, yeah. Which means if they got a couple of more calls, unsubstantiated calls, they'd be fired.
Let's say that HR, the person makes the complaint, HR said, well, look, we'll convene a meeting between yourself and Walter. Sit down. We'll talk about this. You can explain why you were unhappy with him saying the word. And the person, let's say they said, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to make him upset. You know, he was executive producer of Snowfall. I might be applying to him for a job on a future show. I'm afraid that, you know, he'd get upset with me if I did that. So then what should HR do in a case like that, Walter?
Listen, I don't care about any of that. I mean, listen, I just don't care about it. If somebody has a problem with me, I need to have a conversation. And to have somebody else call me and say, well, you now here's your first warning. And by the by, the person who talked to me also said at the same time, he said, well, they say use the N-word. They say, now you have to understand, if you use the C-word, that's what they said to me, we would fire you instantly. So like, so all somebody has to do is call up and say I said something, and then I would be fired. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? How can that be? How can it be that I live in America where people can use words? And one of the major things about America is freedom of speech. Where, this is a country where I can use words, and you tell me I can't say things?
I'd love to hear from our listeners. What do you think of what Walter Mosley is describing, his experience on the Star Trek streamed television series that CBS produces? Walter quit the series after HR contacted him about his use of the racial epithet within the context of telling a story about a police officer using the term. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I welcome your thoughts on this. What do you think about the competing arguments, the employer's standpoint on someone being offended, Walter Mosley's as an artist working in the context of a writer's room, and using this within the context of a story is something that he experienced. 866-893-5722. Back in 1 minute. We're talking with the man who created the character of E.Z. Rollins and so many other critically acclaimed works of fiction and nonfiction, television writer and producer as well, Walter Mosley. He's executive producer and writer on the FX series Snowfall. And until recently, he was a writer on the CBS All Access streaming Star Trek series. But he resigned from the show after HR contacted him because of a complaint from one of the people in the room at a writer's meeting where Walter Mosley used the N-word in recounting a story involving a police officer. And after HR counseled him, gave him a warning on the use of it, they didn't want to be part of the series anymore. And so this is a violation of his creative rights and rights to free speech. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Phil in Rancho Mirage, you're on AirTalk.
I had a very similar situation happen to me as well, so I completely empathize. I was working at a university, and it was over no one until the president came to me and said, we don't think the faculty can work with you anymore. And because I had used a term, not a racial term, but I had used a term in a closed session with faculty to describe a student. And no one came to me. And then I found out afterward that they were compiling a dossier. No one ever told me it offended them. No one ever said, oh, we don't think it's right to use that term. And then it just, and so finally I did the same thing as well. I quit. And I said, I'm not going to work in this atmosphere where I have to guard, you know, when, quite frankly, I seem to think it's to do with the fact that when did political correctness replace honesty?
Phil, I appreciate your call. Thank you for sharing your experience. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. CSER in Hollywood, you're on AirTalk.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to bring up the point that I can see how somebody who works in that environment, specifically under Walter, may be afraid to bring it up to him for fear of retaliation. I've been in situations like that where it may not be that he gets fired right away, but, you know, if it's not in good graces with him, they, you know, and I don't know, he may be a very nice guy, but it could be something that is a warranted fear. I've definitely been in a situation like that.
All right, CSER, I appreciate it. Walter, you want to respond to that? He understands why someone wouldn't come to you directly.
I get it. I mean, nobody worked for me in the room. I mean, that's an issue. But even if they did, you know, like I can't, I'm not going to try to hide behind the fact that, you know, nobody, you know, worked for me. But the idea is that if I can be in a place and because people are, you know, afraid for whatever reason that they can't face you, then that becomes a problem that needs to be worked out because that person could say three times that, you know, like Alice in Wonderland or something. They can say like Wizard of Oz. Like you could go, I can say if I say it three times, then they get fired. I mean, I understand how people might be bothered, but we have to work out the, you know, how to deal with each other. You know, I wasn't trying to, you know, insult anybody. And yeah, it's true. Some people might hold a grudge. That's also true. You know, it's not that it's an easy answer, but, you know, to kind of have a secret thing, say, well, I can't tell you who, but if you do it again, you're going to get fired. That's not right either. So how does one work it out? I don't, honestly, in this situation, I don't think that was the problem.
Yeah. All right. Hold on. Walter Mosley with us on Air Talk. Shelley in Hollywood, I understand you're a television writer.
I am. I'm an African-American television writer. I've been doing it for 20 years, and it's so frustrating to listen to this because they want us in these rooms so that their numbers look a certain way, ostensibly to want to hear our stories. And when we try and tell our stories, they're not objecting to the language that we use. When these type of experiences happen to African-Americans across the country, be it a police officer or someone just walking down the street, and it seems like the context is not being taken into question. It's not like he was calling somebody a name or insulting anyone. He was telling a story about something that happened to him. So now you're not allowed to share your experience because that word is offensive. It was also offensive when somebody called him that word.
Well, and I think Shelley, you're underlining the point too, that in saying the actual word in that writer's meeting, it has much more of a visceral effect. It's much truer to the story than if he'd used a euphemism for it instead of saying it. So, and Walter, do you want to comment on why you used the word? Because I think that is understandable, that there's a power in using the actual word as you did.
Well, listen to me. I the way I look at it is like this. I'll just go to another place. Somebody come up to me and said, well, that person said the N-word. Somebody feeling so free to say the N-word, is actually worse than saying the word itself. I mean, for me, it's like, oh, so now you're free to say it because you have, you know, like, it's not really it, but it is it. Everybody knows what you're saying, but it's not really the word, you know. It's like saying the F word or the C word or any of those things. It's like, come on, man, you know what you're, well, we know what you're talking about. But now it opens up. You can say it as many times as you want. You say, you know, N-word, 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 N-word. You know, it's like, oh, well, it's fine because they didn't really say the word. I mean, that's, you know, for me, as far as that's
okay.
concerned.
Well,
I just wanted to say another thing about
yeah.
I talked to an African-American, a black woman, who was talking to her boss, who was a white woman, and said, well, you know, as a black woman, and actually the white boss corrected her, and she said, no, African-American woman. She corrected a woman about what she says about herself. I mean, there's a thing about using language in this way and being vulnerable to language. And believe me, I'm not just saying that black people can do this. If a white person told the same story I told, I would have to listen to it and hear it. I might not like it. I might be bothered by it.
Would you be? Well, so let's say someone witnessed the same incident that you did and was recounting, because as you did, you thought it was relevant to the conversation in the room. Would you have been offended if a white person had used the term same way, same context you did?
You know, if it bothered me or not, I'm not sure. But I am certain that I would accept the fact that they used language that was used in their presence or used language to express something. Because I'm an American, and people need to use language. Like in my essay, in my op-ed for New York Times, I said, you know, people come up to me and said, we should make the Confederate flag illegal. And I said, absolutely not. Every person in America has a right to express what they believe and what they feel. And on top of that, if what they believe and what they feel is on their front door, that's good. I get to know who they are. You know, so I'm like, you know, as much as I might be unhappy about something somebody says or how they say it or who they say it to, at the end, I know I'm an American. I have my rights. And if I have my rights, then you have yours. And that's fine.
Walter Mosley, great to talk with you again. Thanks so much for coming on and talking about your personal experience with this incident. We appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. Walter Mosley, acclaimed novelist, writer, television producer and writer as well, until recently on CBS's all-access streamed Star Trek series. His essay in the New York Times last Friday, Why I Quit the Writer's Room. Thanks so much for joining us for Air Talk on 89.3. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Tomorrow, 10 o'clock, Air Talk. We're going to be talking about the Democratic presidential candidates debate this afternoon at 5 o'clock. You have a chance to see it and to weigh in with your thoughts on it, particularly if it changed your mind about one or more of the candidates. We'll look forward to hearing your calls. That's tomorrow at 10, Air Talk on KPCC.